From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. How do you define terrorism? In his speech yesterday, President Obama argued that we should no longer engage in a boundless global war on terror. So what is the nature of the threat that America and the world still face? What constitutes terrorism? Are they individual acts like the brutal killing of a British soldier in London or the Boston Marathon bombing? Are they localized attacks taking place in places like Benghazi, or are there more organized and far-reaching threats that still exist? How we define terrorism matters because it shapes how we respond to both individual acts as well as matters of national policy and our national values. Defining terrorism, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In his speech on terrorism yesterday, President Obama said this.
We must define the nature and scope of this struggle, or else it will define us.
So how do we define terrorism? As Columbia University professor Bruce Hoffman has noted, few words have so worked their way into our everyday vocabulary as terrorism. And it's a word and a definition that has specific consequences, because when we say something is an act of terrorism, we respond, whether that's viscerally or by how we vote. And so in a week when a horrific attack in London riveted and revolted the world, and in a week when President Obama tried to reframe the administration's terrorism policy, we want to spend this hour talking about this most impactful of words, terrorism, how we define it, and how that meaning shapes both the nature of our response to it and also the nature of who we are. We're going to hear different points of view on this question throughout our hour, and we want to engage you in our conversation as well. So go ahead and join us, call us, post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website, email us. How do you define terrorism? What does it mean to you? And how do you think that definition, in turn, defines us? Let me start by just reading one posting on our Facebook page from Jeff, who writes these questions. Does the perpetrator's motivation make a difference in whether or not a crime is terrorism? Does the number of people killed or hurt define that it's terrorism? One of the things I noticed, Jeff writes, after the murder in Great Britain is that the perpetrators are being labeled Islamists. Does their religious affiliation matter in terms of labeling something terrorism? I haven't worked out my answers to these questions, Jeff writes, but those are the questions that I'm considering. And those are the questions, among many others, that we want to consider during this hour as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786 to be a part of our conversation. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can also post your thoughts and questions on our Facebook page. I want to hear first from Mark Danner. He is Chancellor's Professor of Journalism and Politics at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, and War. Professor Danner, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. It's good to be here, Dave.
So give us your current thinking in this week where the president gave this speech, where we had this horrific murder in London, and this word that so informs us and inflames us and makes such a difference in terms of both the policies we enact and the values that we hold. What are you thinking about right now?
Well, the word is a mess, and 12 years of the war on terror have certainly not served to make it any narrower and more specific. There are definitions in law, and the CIA has one, official one, State Department, Defense Department, all have definitions of terrorism. Usually they focus on a variation of this, violence used to influence a third party, an audience, and to promote a political cause. That is that the violence itself is not the critical part. The killing is, in fact, a means to an end, a means to influence an audience, to terrorize an audience, and in some way to advance a political motivation. That is a rather complicated definition. It also focuses very much on civilians, one should add, which means that when attacks are on military targets, for example, like the Beirut barracks in 1983 in Lebanon, this, strictly speaking, is not terrorism under those definitions. The broader thing to say, I think, here is that the president has, as you see in his speech yesterday, recognized the way that our approach to terrorism has become a kind of endless war, has taken in a lot of things that don't properly belong under the definition, and threatens to hold us in its grasp, in fact, forever. And I think one of the interesting things about the speech yesterday is a statement by him, really, of a beginning to end the forever war, and to take some acts that we now call terrorism and put them in the realm of law enforcement. I mean, Boston would be an example of that. These are things that, more properly speaking, can be called murder. I mean, they have a terrorist element, but they are not part of the war on terror, and they can be dealt with through law enforcement as they were before.
And why why does that distinction make a difference, Mark Danner, as far as let's drill down on Boston for a moment. Why does it matter how we slate that?
Well, it's a very good question. You know, in essence, we have been on a war footing or a quasi war footing for 12 years, and the fact is, if we remain on this war footing until every terrorist is eliminated, we will be on that war footing forever because, you know, Boston is a great example. A couple of very young men, one of them a college student, who got on the Internet. I mean, there may have been connections to elements in Chechnya or Dagestan. We don't know that yet. But basically figured out how to do this, make these bombs on the Internet, and launched this attack apparently, you know, just between themselves, figured it out between themselves and did it. And, you know, if you are essentially saying, look, until every one of people like that is eliminated, until you have no threat of that sort anymore, we are going to maintain this war on terror. The United States will be at war, quote unquote, into the indefinite future and in, you know, forever. And already this war has lasted a dozen years. The question is, how do you end it? And one way to end it is to say that the main threat that we're talking about, the threat that was envisioned by Congress or put in the authorization for the use of military force after September 11th, was Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces. And these are the bodies that posed at some point a quasi-military threat to the country. They have been largely eliminated and destroyed. And what we have left are what we had before September 11, which is, you know, various individuals, right, people who indeed launch murderous attacks. I mean, the London example is another thing. But this is not a war. Yep. This is something different.
So is it to you then fundamentally a question of resources, that we don't need that overarching global war on terror anymore, as the president noted yesterday? And so what's important now is how we focus our resources, or is it also a question of sort of how we define ourselves?
You know, I think the latter is much more important than a question of resources. It's a question of morality. It's a question of civil philosophy. It's a question, as the president said, of who we are. I mean, are we a country that indefinitely detains people in an offshore prison who have not been charged, and half of whom indeed have been cleared for release? Is that what we do? Is that what the United States does? And if we do that, why are we doing it? What exactly is the threat that justifies this? And we've essentially been living in what I've called a state of exception since September 11th, 2001, which is to say a state of emergency, martial law, whatever you'd like to call it, but an exceptional state in which we have suspended a number of very important precepts that we used to consider were essential to who we were as a polity, as a political organism. And I think one of the things the president is saying is it's long past time for us to return to the status quo ante. And I certainly agree with that. In fact, I think he was much too tentative in that statement. The speech in general, I think, could have been much more decisive, but it should be applauded because it was a step along that road. It basically said, we are not going to be a country that is in a continual state of war. And, you know, there is a parallel here that your older listeners will remember, which is the Cold War and what was done with communists. You know, communists could be anywhere. I mean, the communist threat was ever-present, everlasting. We see it in Korea. We see it in Vietnam. We see it in Central America. And this was perceived as endless.
So sorry to jump in, but I'm curious about what you think then the toll of that is on us. Is it then the kind of consequence that plays out in our policies, or is it also something, I don't know, more internal about sort of who we are as a people?
Well, I think there's a moral toll, no question about it. I mean, this country, among other things, has tortured as a matter of policy. No one has been punished for that. And in fact, under President Obama, so far as we know, if you look at the polling results, the support for torture, for using torture, has increased rather than decreased. There's also a political toll. You know, the war on terror has become a defining term in our politics. And you see already a pushback on the president's speech from John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and other Republican senators who are saying, you know, this is the wrong time to lay off the war on terror. We have to, in fact, increase it. You see efforts in Congress to expand the authorization for the use of military force rather than to repeal it, as President Obama talked about doing. So this has become a defining issue in which the Republican Party and parts of the Democratic Party, but especially the Republican Party, essentially say this is the key issue. Are we still fighting a war on terror? We must continue this war on terror. You know, when the Boston bombers were arrested, or one of them was arrested, he should be sent to Guantanamo. Why is he being interrogated by the FBI? He should be in an offshore prison. You know, this has become a political issue in which the Republican Party essentially says, you know, the president and the Democratic administration is coddling terrorists. I mean, it's very similar to the political configuration when it comes that used to be when it came to crime, that you know, the Democrats are coddling criminals. So this has become part of our politics, and it's going to be interesting to see what the results and consequences of this speech are.
So do you hope that this, just a last question, Mark Danner, do you hope that this then launches this sort of big, deeper conversation?
Yes, I hope it will. I hope it will. I mean, the conversation has been very constrained. In fact, this is true since September 11th.
Yeah.
You know, it has been since the beginning, in fact, out of bounds to talk about why those attacks were launched on September 11th, to talk about what American policy in the Middle East might have to do with those, to talk about the general term, you know, why they hate us. I mean, this has been this discussion, such as it has been, has been conducted completely out of the political and policy realm, has nothing to do, at least we're told, with what U.S. policies are in the world, with, you know, why Pakistanis think of Americans the way they do, the Palestinian-Israeli problem. None of these things have anything to do with it. It's just they're evildoers. And that is a discussion that is essentially politically tone-deaf, politically stupid. So we sit there when these Boston bombers strike, and, you know, we're reduced to saying, well, gee, these guys, you know, they liked hamburgers, they liked America. Why would they do this? We have no idea. What would lead people, what would motivate them to carry on such attacks? And I think part of that reason is because the discussion we've had in the last dozen years has been almost determinedly unpolitical. And I think that has to change.
Mark Danner, the professor, Chancellor's Professor of Journalism and Politics at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, and War. Mark, thank you. Thanks for getting us started in our conversation today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Want to hear from a couple of you, and then we'll go to our next guest with a different perspective on this issue. Let's hear from Jane first in our conversation. Jane, go ahead with your thoughts on this question.
My question is that I wondered why, when people were filming and looking at what was going on in that town in England, why they didn't rise up and try to stop these men from hacking the soldier to death.
Yeah. So your question is really more about how these acts have affected us and whether or not we're...
Yeah, and why aren't we, you know, why didn't they as individuals rise up and try to stop these people rather than just looking at them and watching them? And I haven't heard anything in the news about, you know, that question of really ethics or trying to stop them from what they were doing.
All right, Jane, thanks for raising that point. Be interested to hear other people on that point. How do you think our focus on terrorism and our concerns about that are impacting how we act? And yet, put it differently, how should we respond to those actions? And how might we act and more aggressively fight back against those sorts of horrific actions as we saw in London? You can join our conversation about the definition of terrorism, what it means, how it's affecting us, and what it means in the future. We want to carry out that conversation throughout our hour today and have you join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We're going to hear next from Frank Gaffney. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, formerly the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy during the administration of President Ronald Reagan. Mr. Gaffney, thanks for being with us. Frank Gaffney, have you joined us?
I have, yes, indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So on the question of what the president put forward yesterday and his sense that we need to bring this war to an end, as he said, because all wars must end, do you think that's an appropriate point at this point, that we need to sort of redefine what the war on terrorism really means? Or has he declared victory way too soon?
I'm not sure he's declaring victory. It sounded to me from what he was saying in this context, as in Afghanistan before it and before that in Iraq, is we're just done. We're not going to fight this war anymore. And the trouble with that is, throughout history, is that unless the other party to the war decides that they're done too, you are, as a practical matter, surrendering. And they will continue, and it may get a lot worse, in fact. Interestingly enough, I arrive at very much the same bottom line, I guess, as Mark Danner, but I'm a little at odds with him on almost all of the reasons why he does. Let me just, if I may, explain what I would say about this terrorism business. We do need a national debate about the nature of the conflict we are in. I certainly think we didn't have it at the very beginning when we started getting serious about this after 9/11, and I don't think we've had it really ever since then. I would argue that terrorism has been a euphemism because we elected, first under the Bush administration and then under the Obama administration. In fact, the Obama administration wouldn't even approve that euphemism by and large. It chose instead violent extremism as the thing we needed to deal with. But both of them, again, were surrogates for what is, as a practical matter, at the heart of this conflict. And that is the jihadism that our enemies engage in because they believe that their God commands them to do so, according to a doctrine they call Sharia. Now, to be sure, there are other people, have been throughout history, who have used terroristic techniques, terrifying violence, for political purposes. But the vast majority of the problem that we are confronting, and the problem I fear that the president, with his remarks of yesterday, as well as most of the policy he has pursued since he came to office, is making infinitely worse, is impelled by this doctrine of Sharia and those who believe that God tells them they must use violent jihad where they can to impose it on the rest of us, and where they can't, because it's impracticable, because it might be counterproductive, they use other techniques, stealthy kinds of techniques of jihad.
So from a standpoint of defining where we are now and what we need to focus on, it sounds like from what you're saying, Frank Gaffney, that there is to you, after the word terrorism, an equals sign to Islamist radicalism. Is that right? And is that where you think all our focus ought to be placed?
Let me put this in my own words, if I may.
Yeah.
I think that what we're dealing with is a phenomenon of Hillary Clinton, of all people, recently called it global jihadism, that has both a violent manifestation, terrifying, if you will, and a stealthy kind of jihad. The Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, is the prime practitioner of the latter, where they think violence won't work, at least at the moment. They call it civilization jihad. And I think that's absolutely what we should be focusing on, both the violent and what you might think of as really the pre-violent kinds of jihad. And that's what we need a national debate about, because here's the really frightening thing to me. The decision as to whether, in the eyes of, say, the Muslim Brotherhood, whom, by the way, the Obama administration has now turned over large stretches of the Middle East to, or is in the process of doing so, or helping achieve that end.
Do you mean because of, as in Egypt? Or
as in Egypt most especially, and Tunisia, yeah, and Libya, soon to be Syria, perhaps Jordan, perhaps Bahrain, perhaps, who knows, Saudi Arabia, but on and on. The problem is, when he tells us that Al-Qaeda core has been defeated and now that problem is really licked, it is the worst, at best naivete, and really in practice, I think, delusion and deception. The trouble is, when people are thinking that they can't use violence against us just yet because it's not, you know, the right circumstances, the differentiating the point, the tipping point, if you will, to going violent, because that's where they're supposed to go, ultimately, according to the teachings of Sharia, is whether they see us submitting. If they do, that is evidence that they must go to the next stage, the violent stage. And that's what's so frightening about the president's remarks yesterday, his decision he's going to very narrowly circumscribe the use of some of the tools that we've used to try to contend with this problem, whether it's Guantanamo Bay or whether it's drones. And most especially, the failure to understand and to talk honestly with the American people about what we're up against, whether it's in Boston, whether it's in London, whether it's in Sweden, whether it's in parts of the Middle East or elsewhere in the free world.
So do you draw a linkage then between all of those things, between what happened in Boston to what happened in Benghazi, let's say, or do all of these things, are they all connected to you? And to what extent then does that define where our focus ought to be?
It really doesn't matter whether they're connected to me. It matters whether everybody involved in these activities believes they have a connection with one another. And they do. They believe it is jihad that they are engaged in. They believe it is God's will that they engage in it. We have deluded ourselves, as I say. We have been blinded to this reality for far too long, and it's getting to a point now. I mean, when a man gets up on the streets of London with his hands bloody because he's been butchering a British soldier, and he tells you that he was inspired to do it by Quranic verses, and he shouted, Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest, the call of the jihadists, we say that it's not got anything to do with that at our extreme peril. And again, it is malfeasance, I believe, for national security professionals to persist in this behavior.
Frank Gaffney joining us. He is the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, formerly Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration. Mr. Gaffney, stay with us, if you would, please. We're coming up against a break. I want to pose a few more questions to you when we return about the consequence of the policy that you're outlining that you think we ought to maintain. And we want to hear from all of you as well. 866-733-6786. Do you agree with what Frank Gaffney is saying about the threat that is there? And if so, what does that mean in terms of who we are as a people and how we ought to focus our efforts going forward? 866-733-6786. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. We'll get to all of that when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, terrorism. What does the word mean? How will that influence where we go forward as a country and as individuals? How will this inform the kind of policies that we undertake? How will this inform who we are? We're joined by Frank Gaffney, who was an Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. And Mr. Gaffney, I want to have you take a couple of calls, and we'll just do them back to back because they each have points of view concerning some of the things you've been saying. John, go ahead first with your question, and then I'm going to move to one more caller. But John, go ahead and pose your question for Frank Gaffney. John, are you with us? Oh, don't have John. All right, let's go next to Carl, who has an observation for Frank Gaffney. Carl, go ahead.
Now, I didn't hear the president's speech yesterday, but I feel that he has been surrendering, for instance, in Syria, you know, with this total hands-off thing for, you know, like 800 or 900 days watching mass murder. And the people watching murder in London, like the woman earlier called in and said, and I've been wondering about that too, I think that, you know, it's obvious that the police and security structures can't protect individuals. It took 20 minutes for the police to get there. People should be carrying firearms or whatever, as many people as possible who are able and trained and responsible, because that's the only way that you can protect yourself. And if the president is going to surrender and declare, like Frank Gaffney is saying, who I happen to agree with totally, then, you know, it's up to us to get Congress to vote.
Okay. I'm going to hold you there, Carl. We get the essence of your point of view, and now I want to hear an opposite point of view from John, who joins us next in San Francisco. So, John, if you would.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, hi. I just have to challenge Mr. Gaffney.
Oh, okay. I'm going to hold you there, Carl. We get the.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, John.
Hello?
John, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to challenge Mr. Gaffney's take that somehow Islamic jihadism is somehow different than terrorism. I mean, I had the privilege of studying with Martha Crenshaw, who is a distinguished scholar of terrorist studies, and she actually wrote a great set of articles in early 2000s after 9/11 saying, you know, all of this cry that somehow jihadism is a new form of terrorism just ignores the history of what terrorism has been, that terrorism is an end, as your earlier speaker said, it's a means to an end.
Yeah.
And most of the people who have been, you know, somehow linked to jihadist movements are doing it with the knowledge of what that end is. You know, we may not agree with that end, but it is in many ways both a political as well as a religious end, and it's not that different from terrorism that had other political ends, whether it was the Irgun or whether it was the, you know, the IRA. And I just think I have to also indicate that, you know, Mr. Gaffney has been called out for some of his kind of extremist views by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Well, let's hold. I'm going to hold you there, John. I understand your point, but what I wanted to try to do, and Frank Gaffney, now I turn it back to you, is to frame those differing points of view. One who is strongly in support of you, John, who's raising lots of concerns. So take those all in, if you would, and describe sort of what your point of view is about both the need that Carl suggested that it is all about jihadism, and John's contrary point that this is part of a continuum and that we're missing the point if we somehow define this only as global jihadism.
Well, with respect to John's comments, I think there may be less disagreement than meets the eye. I'm certainly not suggesting that jihadists don't use terrorism. They do. I'm simply saying that when we say the problem is terrorism, or worse, the problem is violent extremism, and therefore we can basically equate anybody that the Southern Poverty Law Center says is a hate monger, and I'm among those that they have defamed that way, as though they're as bad a threat to this country as is Al-Qaeda or perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm simply saying that we do need to worry about terrorists of other stripes, of course. And by and large, that is a law enforcement problem. When you have people who use violent means and other means, these stealthy civilization jihadist means, for the purpose of subverting our country and destroying it from within, which is, by the way, exactly the way the Muslim Brotherhood has described their mission in America, and you ignore that, because you're going to focus over there at core al-Qaeda, or you're going to say, well, it's just that violent extremism. You are, I believe, leaving the American people and other freedom-loving people exposed to sedition on the one hand, and more violence than anything we've seen to date. And I have to tell you that some of the commentary that I've been hearing recently that, well, this thing, and the president kind of alluded to it yesterday, it's petering out. The people are now just down to hatchets and pressure cooker bombs. Nonsense. There is much worse coming. And especially if I'm right, and I fear I am, that they're perceiving in our submissiveness to their jihad the impetus, the call to engage in more of it, you can bet that what you're going to be seeing is vastly more destructive attacks on this country and its people and others we care about elsewhere around the world.
Frank Gaffney, the president and CEO for the Center for Security Policy. Thank you for adding your point of view to this and outlining what you believe the stakes are in this conversation that we're having. Frank Gaffney, thanks very much.
Thank you for having the conversation and having me on it.
Yeah, thank you. I want to read some of the comments that are coming in before we get to our next guest that people are posting. Max writes, to me, what happened in London this week can't be called terrorism because the person who killed was a combatant. Since we no longer have declared wars, governments assume the privilege of declaring anyone a combatant. They use this declaration to declare that their own killings are justifiable. Ross writes, it's disturbing to see definition creep with terrorism. For instance, I recently heard someone say that someone who shot a police officer should be considered a terrorist. I think that's a ridiculous way to use the T word. Andrew posts on Facebook, unfortunately, I believe the use of the word terror in our political and electoral rhetoric is indicative of a greater issue, our embracing of a culture of fear. Far more people die every year from things like automobile accidents, drug and alcohol problems, and so forth. We are using fear too much, and it's such a loaded word to use it with the high frequency that we do. Ken writes, terror equals killing people who are not trying to kill you. That's my definition. Daniel says, here in Northern California, it's anybody that commits a crime that's disturbing the public. That seems to be what we define as terrorists. And some specifically to what Frank Gaffney was saying. Frank Gaffney for speaking the truth about the threat of radical Islam. We need to stop being so naive and so politically correct. Many comments coming in. And now we're joined by Laura Beth Nielsen, who is a professor at the American Bar Foundation, also associate professor of sociology, director of the Center for Legal Studies at Northwestern University, wrote a very thoughtful piece about the meaning of this word this week. Professor Nielsen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
So you've overheard some of our conversation. I want to turn to you at this point and sort of ask you to help us put this word in some perspective in terms of how you think it would be useful for us to consider this word and consider the conversation that we ought to be having.
Well, I'm certainly willing to try to help. I think one of the things that both President Obama's speech yesterday did and the conversation that you're having today does that we haven't done much of for the past 12 years is to begin to think about what are the embedded meanings when we use this word terrorism? What are we really talking about? Are we talking about violent acts by individuals? What are the definitions? And what is going with the word when it's being deployed by law enforcement, by politicians, and by ordinary citizens? And so in the Boston case, one of the issues that troubled me was the immediate use of the word terrorism to describe the incident, both by news reporters, but also even by President Obama before we had an idea of who these bombers were, who did apparently turn out to be terrorists. But when we use that word for ordinary people, and that's who I study, how ordinary people understand the law and how the legal categories frame our understanding of what's happening in the world. So for ordinary people, when on television the president is saying this is terrorism, or newspaper reporters are saying this might be terrorism, it looks like terrorism, that comes with an embedded set of meanings. And right now, in this historical moment in the United States, that has a particular face. It's a Muslim, Middle Eastern Muslim man. And that leads to assumptions being made, perhaps less effective police enforcement, because when they're saying, help us look, what tips do you have? We think it's terrorism. The image of the white guys might not come into our brains. And so the use of the word, like one of the comments you just read said there's definition creep. I think there's definition creep and there's embedded meaning creep, and we don't know what each other are talking about, and it's not helping us to have a precise conversation. So I'm thrilled that President Obama wants to say, hey, now when I'm talking about terrorism, I'm going to draw some distinctions between the kind of organized Al-Qaeda, 9/11 type of structure and the kind of thing that we need to be looking at for perhaps homegrown or domestic terrorists that are going to plant pressure cooker bombs, because our law enforcement strategy and our judicial strategy is going to be different for those kinds of and our, you know, foreign policy strategy is going to be different for those different kinds of terrorists.
So would you separate then the Boston Marathon bombing and, let's say, before that, Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma City? Well, two questions, really. Would you consider those the same, the difference being perhaps one only of religion? Well, respond to that first, and then I'll go to my second.
Well, I think they both meet what Mark was saying, the definition, and I think Frank agreed, the definition of terrorism, sort of the legal definition, and of course there are changes over time and laws get, but sort of the standard legal basis of terrorism is, right, it's the use of force directed towards, some people say towards innocent people, but certainly not directed towards people who, there's a third party audience, right, and that's the government, and you're doing it for a purpose, which is to advance your social or religious or political goals. So in that way, they're very similar, but the way that you would police to try to prevent those kinds of terrorist activities within the borders of the United States would be very different, because it's, you have scale issues, and they were coming out of different kinds of hate groups, or, you know, people willing to engage in violence to make their point. And how you interface with and investigate militia groups is going to be very different than how you investigate religious groups in the United States.
And then from that point, then, do you then sort of put these in different buckets, though, that kind of analogous group, though understanding the difference that you just suggested between militia and religious, is that just a whole different set of focus that we ought to have, as opposed to focusing on what remains of Al-Qaeda?
I think absolutely, it's different in how you're going to police it. It's different in how you're going to prosecute it. But it is a law enforcement model is perfectly capable of dealing with all of these different kinds of terrorism. There are a lot of crimes here, right? So with Timothy McVeigh, you have multiple murders. You have transportation of dangerous weapons. For the Boston bombers, you have deploying a weapon in a public place, transporting a weapon into a public place. But there are plenty of crimes here. And when we add this word murder, you know, multiple assault, when you add the word terrorism, it takes away from understanding what are these crimes, how are we going to charge them, what can our justice system do with them. And we've done pretty well in our history, you know, aside from Guantanamo, but within the U.S. borders, we've done pretty well trying terrorists. And so there's no reason not to put them in the justice model. And I think that's what Obama is trying to get back to. I wish we had done it sooner, but I'm thrilled that we're doing it now, because we have an obligation to the Constitution to be an example and to live out our values. Of course, in times of war or in times of crisis, we have a long history of rescinding constitutional rights from the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War II. So we have a history of it, but we look back on it with regret.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I think he's starting to say, okay, we need to figure out a way to get past this moment where we're suspending a lot of constitutional rights and freedoms here and around the world, and begin to think of this as a period that's behind us, and hopefully stop producing more terrorists.
Let me ask you to respond to a couple of our listener observations.
Sure.
Nalaman joins us first in San Jose. Nalaman, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say maybe we're looking at this from a wrong angle. To me, it looks like as long as the point of global equality is not really addressed, we're going to have terrorism, call it whatever you want, growing and growing inside our country and outside our country. But we are really more of a global war, and if we don't address global injustice and global inequality, we're going to be talking about titles like terrorists or not terrorists for the times to come, and it will never end.
Nelliman, thank you. Professor Nielsen?
Well, I completely agree. And one of the most interesting things in the speech that people haven't really been talking very much about is this discussion about foreign aid and how not only can we be strengthening foreign governments and civil society in poor foreign countries, that grows our national security. And so he was talking about foreign aid being, you know, 1% of the budget, even though most people think it's quite a bit more. So why don't we consider that part of our national security budget? Why isn't building schools in Pakistan and educating women throughout the Middle East part of our national security strategy? I think it's exactly right. And the more we can get back to providing foreign aid that develops nations where they can be meaningful participants in the global world order, the more they're going to be willing to participate in ways that are fruitful and not violent.
Sort of like what we saw after the tsunami, that the view of the United States and that part of the world went up considerably because of the aid that was delivered by former President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton,
who led that
effort. Last question for you. You heard, I think, Mark Danner earlier say that he was that he wished the president had been less ambivalent and more specific. We heard Frank Gaffney say that he thought the president was really on the wrong track here and was leaving us incredibly vulnerable. I'm wondering what you think about it. Was striking yesterday to have the president be ambivalent to a degree. And I'm wondering if you think that's OK, that maybe we're at a time where that sort of questioning and ambivalence, if you will, is maybe something that's appropriate.
I think that's right. And I think that is, I think the exact question that you're talking about here today is the question that he was trying to raise, which is, what do we mean by this word? What are we doing? How much effort do we want to be putting into this? How many of our core constitutional values are we willing to sacrifice because of fear? And it's going to be really, I mean, I don't know how you could ever possibly measure, you know, are you producing more terrorists through drone strikes? Or are you preventing them? I mean, people with access to all kinds of classified information that I don't have access to disagree about those things, right? So it's hard to know, but it's really important to be talking about it because this is our government's face to much of the world. And we need, ordinary citizens need to be saying to their elected officials what they think about it.
Laura Beth Nielsen, research professor at the American Bar Foundation, associate professor at Northwestern University. Thanks for helping us think about it this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
We're joined next by Danielle Pletka, vice president for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, for another point of view on this subject. Danielle Pletka, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So let's just pick up on that point with a first thought from you. Then we'll have to pause and we'll continue. But on this question of when you watched President Obama yesterday, this question of is it useful to be sort of engaging this kind of these sort of ruminations, if you will, about where we are with terror? Or do you think that's revealing a kind of ambivalence and indifference that will harm us?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is complicated in many ways. The president hasn't spent a lot of time on national security. I think a lot of people noted that the speech that he gave yesterday, which was an hour long, was really his first serious delving into national security questions since almost the beginning of his first term. He's given some shorter speeches on issues here and there, but this was the first sort of big and important speech that he gave, and I think it's very important that the president, as commander-in-chief, when we are at war, spend a lot more time with the American people talking about these things. So on the one hand, a good thing that he did that, in the sense that it was a sort of a strange and almost psychiatric session that the president spent going back and forth. On the one hand, on the other hand, I'm tortured and moral, but am I moral and right and just? That I think was not terribly helpful, although I'm sure that it was appealing to some in the president's base who have been distressed by his continued use of drones, by his prosecution of the war in Afghanistan, and by the fact that Guantanamo is still open.
But why is it a problem to it is striking. I completely agree, but I'm curious about why you think it's a problem to have a president say on the one hand, on the other hand.
Well, again, I think that it's important. I don't think it's a problem per se to have a president say on the one hand, on the other hand. We like our presidents to be thoughtful. On the other hand, we like our presidents to be leaders. And so while I think that it is acceptable and even wise to ponder the difficulties in such things, I think at the same time, leaving a strong sense of vagueness and lack of leadership out there is not a good thing for either the American people or our adversaries.
Daniel Pletka, Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Stay with us. We must pause, though. This is a fundraising period on KQED. To find out more about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. Let me read a comment to you, Daniel Pletka, that just came in. Jonathan writes, terrorism has become one of the most abused terms in international relations. When defining terrorism, it's important to highlight the issue of political motivation. That is how you delineate most acts of terrorism from crime. Is that the key point that you think we need to bear in mind as we have this conversation? And where do you think our resources need to be devoted as far as the definition that we agree to?
Well, the definition of terrorism is something that's been hard fought, and I'd say that no particular author of any definition has won the day. The U.S. government has several different definitions in law, and if you look it up, you know, it's a little bit like the old adage about pornography. Mm. You know it when you see it. I think we all generally agree that it is the pursuit of political ends through violence, and where do you draw the line between various different kinds of terrorism? You know, that's a difficult question, and one that I think is something that needs to be engaged with a national dialogue. We've had a national dialogue about this. We've had successive presidents talk about this. We've had Congress wrestle with these issues. I'm not dissatisfied with the nature of this conversation, but as for the question of how we should deal with it, I do think the president was right. This is not a war, and I believe it is a war, but this is not a war that will be won by the tip of the spear. We do need to address the challenge that we face in the space where terrorism is growing. Make no mistake, though, terrorism is growing. Al-Qaeda itself is growing in strength and spreading, and we need to recognize that. Aid alone won't do it, and the military alone won't do it. We need a sophisticated strategy. I didn't hear that yesterday from the president.
Fill in the dots, then. Where would you like to have had him go that he did not?
Well, one of the things that I think was very disappointing was the president's sort of insistence that this can be handled as a law enforcement matter. You know, a lot of the facts about our fight with Islamist extremist groups are not known or not often discussed. So, for example, we have these drone strikes. Let's just set aside the question of whether they're good or bad for a moment and recognize that we actually have a decreasing number of them and that we don't do many of them in places like Yemen. Now, why is that? Well, it's because we don't have any folks on the ground. The reason we're able to do this in Afghanistan and Pakistan is because we've got troops on the ground who gather intelligence, who know where terrorists are, who know where they're plotting and planning. We're not going to have that in the future. One of the other problems, we don't interrogate people anymore. Now, you may not like interrogation, you may not like waterboarding, but even the simple question of being able to interrogate somebody accused of planning terrorism is now in question. That means we don't have intelligence to prevent these sorts of things. So this is really a very fraught challenge and one that doesn't deserve the sort of dismissal that the president gave yesterday about how we can hit people with drones as long as there's no collateral damage and everybody can just be put in maximum security prison. How are they going to be put in prison? Where's the evidence going to come from? And how are you going to answer the question of what we do about highly classified intelligence in a court of law? The president left that all out there.
So are you saying, in essence, that it's not so much that al-Qaeda has been diminished? Rather, the question is, we don't know.
To the contrary, I think we do know al-Qaeda has not been diminished. Al-Qaeda is not just the base, as they describe themselves. That's what the word means. It is an intricate web of organizations that are growing around the world. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the man who attacked a soldier and killed him in Woolwich in England, or the Boston Marathon bombers are members of that group. But it does mean that from Yemen to Somalia to Pakistan to Afghanistan to Syria to Iraq to the Sinai, and I could continue for a while here, that we are seeing increasingly potent al-Qaeda-related groups that have the aim of killing Americans.
But I hear you also saying that we need to keep our eyes on the ball here, and that if we get too focused on pulling back, that we just won't have the ears on the ground that are necessary to know who it is out there that we have to worry about.
That's what distresses me. Great example yesterday from the president's speech. He said, I want to take these men out of Guantanamo and I want to send them to Yemen. Now, that ignores the question of why we didn't send them to Yemen in the first place, a decision, by the way, that was made by the president himself. And that is that we could not be confident that when we sent them to Yemen, that they were not going to reengage in terrorism. And, frankly, our entire strategy in Yemen is now in question because there are mutinies going on within our allied Yemeni military that is fighting al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. So, you know, again, none of this lends itself to a sort of easy answer or the kind of feel-good talk that we got from the president yesterday.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Daniel Plotkov, for joining our conversation, for adding your point of view to it. It's an important one that we will no doubt continue. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online assistance from David Marks. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.